You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Asahi Pompei. Asahi is a partner at Goldman Sachs, a member of its management committee, and she's also the head of the Goldman Sachs Foundation. And today we're going to talk with her about how corporations go about determining their philanthropic priorities and also get into some of the Goldman Sachs initiatives, particularly ones aimed at Black women. They've just launched a program to support 1 million Black women with a $10 billion investment over a period of 10 years. So we're going to talk with Asahi about that and also get into her career a little bit as a Black woman in corporate America. Asahi, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Art, it's terrific to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
So Asahi, I can't help but ask you, as a Black woman yourself, and I know Goldman's investing a lot in Black women, how has it been for you to rise to such an amazing level inside of a venerable company like Goldman Sachs?
You know, it's been a wild ride. I've been at Goldman 16 years now. And, you know, Art, if you'd asked me when I joined, if, you know, I thought I'd be in the position that I am today, I would have said absolutely no way. And I really attribute it to a number of things: amazing mentors and sponsors along the way. Yes, a lot of hard work, but frankly, a lot of luck as well, right? You know, I think, you know, we sometimes tend to attribute our success to ourselves when in fact, there's so many other factors that really go into it. And luck and, you know, the goodness of so many people that you interact with is a huge, huge part of it. So I'm humbled by that.
Well, and given what you do, you are also able to put Goldman's face forward as a philanthropic engine for our country and for the causes that you support. How does it feel to not only be in a position to help the firm thrive financially, but to also give back to community?
You know, it's a tremendous sense of responsibility because I leave a bit of part of myself in this job, right? You think about it on the weekend, you think about it when you wake up in the morning, at night, and it's something that we take every decision very, very seriously because I know ultimately that every dollar that I allocate to one cause or one charity is a dollar that frankly isn't being allocated to another also very deserving organization. And so I think the way I describe it is just feeling a real sense of the weight of that responsibility and the importance of making the best decisions that we possibly can.
So let's get into some of that. You guys have to prioritize how you're spending your money. How do you go about that? What is it that has led you, for instance, to making an investment of $10 billion over 10 years to support Black women? How did you come to that?
You know, I love this question because it really gets at the crux of what I think is one of the hardest things that we do, which is there's so many deserving organizations, deserving causes, so many places that, frankly, we need to make more progress in society. How does a corporation, a corporate foundation decide where to meet that need, where to allocate those funds? And I love that you highlight our newest initiative, which was launched in March of this year called 1 Million Black Women. And as you know, it's a $10 billion commitment over the course of the next 10 years to positively impact the lives of at least a million Black women, called a million Black women. It's the largest commitment ever in the history of this country, specifically focused on Black women. And, you know, how we came to that, Art, was really very much data driven, right? And so I would say of the pillars of how we go about decision making, very much being driven by the data. And, you know, one thing I'll mention is it really started in the research. And so we published a report called Black Womenomics. And it really highlighted this 90% wealth gap between a Black woman in this country and a white man. And her net worth is roughly $8,000 a year. Pulled together everything that she owns, it's $8,000. His net worth is roughly $92,000 a year. And while that's a stark difference, the thing that really gets me is to think about what kind of life unfolds for the little girl or the little boy that's living in the house where the net worth of mom is $8,000. What unfolds in terms of the grandparents and the spouse and the cousins and that whole network from a community perspective when that's the net worth of the individual? And conversely, you know, what kind of life can unfold with a $92,000 net worth? And so it's from that sort of data-driven approach that we said, Goldman Sachs knows a good investment when we see it. And Black women are a good investment. And if we can be a needle to sort of narrow that 90% wealth gap, then we could positively impact the lives of so many people, not only Black people, but people across this country. And so we were excited to launch that initiative this past March.
So what are some of the things that the initiative will cover?
So I would think about the initiative in terms of two key areas. One is it's a commercial initiative. So it's $10 billion of investment, not philanthropy, but investment, where Goldman Sachs is identifying communities, organizations that we can make debt and equity investments in that will benefit the lives of Black women and girls. So think mixed income housing in the Bronx or Upper Manhattan or in Newark. Think about, you know, sort of narrowing the digital divide that we see for so many children that didn't have access to online schooling during the pandemic, and giving broadband access to more communities of Black communities in particular. So investments is a key portion of it. The second portion of it is this $100 million that's on top of the $10 billion in philanthropy. And there we're looking to really find organizations that are really measuring the impact in terms of positively impacting Black women and girls. So Bernice King and the King Center is one. The Morehouse Medical Center, to which we've made a $3 million investment, is another one. And so those kinds of organizations. So commercial, the 1-2 punch of commercial investments and philanthropy.
Well, this is something that we'll be following up on another major initiative which you've invested in, the firm has invested in, called 10,000 Small Businesses. And I look at that program and I just say, wow, you know, this firm has decided to support organizations. But the way you went about it was really fascinating to me, because historically what we would see is a company investing in organizations who are working in a particular field. So let's assume it was job training, my old area. You know, you would get a grant to an organization doing job training, and they would go out and do the training, and you would take some credit as the grantor. In this particular case, though, as I look at the program, it looks like Goldman is really driving the action. You're in it. You're not just making cash donations. You're doing it. And it's part of, you know, the work of the foundation to actually do that. So I'm really kind of interested in knowing, how did you decide to take it on as a direct responsibility more than just a grant itself?
It's so great to talk with you because you really understand our work and know us so well, Art. You're absolutely right. So think of the Goldman Foundation less as a grant-making foundation and more of an operating foundation, where we are exactly as you described it, in the work, directly working with our institutions, our business owners. So the way that 10,000 Small Businesses works is that we realized that Main Street and Wall Street needed to be closer connected. And that if we could find a way to help these engines of the U.S. economy, which is small business that, you know, it employs the vast majority of Americans are employed by a small business. If Goldman Sachs could be a force for helping small businesses to grow, helping them to hire more individuals, helping them to increase their revenues, open new facilities, then that would have a catalytic impact on the U.S. economy. And so we set about this work over a decade ago to work with small businesses. And the way it works is we provide best-in-class education to business owners who want to grow their business. What's going on with your financials? How are you using social media? How do you get the best negotiation skills so you can get that loan to open that new facility that you've been looking to open? What about your marketing game? Is it up to snuff? Could you be doing more on that? What about advocacy? Lawmakers and our policy influence so much of small business. And so it's this 100-hour robust program, so much so that Harvard came knocking on our door saying, the results that you're seeing from this program are really phenomenal. We want to do a case study on Goldman Sachs 10,000 small businesses to find out how are you getting these kinds of results where we're seeing upwards of, you know, 67% of the businesses reporting increase in revenue, hiring individuals within 6 months of completing the program. But a lot of that really comes back to the point that you highlighted at the very beginning, Art, which is being directly working with our business owners. They have my cell phone number. They speak to Jessica and any number of other individuals on our team. We visit their businesses. We patronize their business. And so, you know, they're vendors to us as well. So it's this close relationship. We're really walking alongside the small business over the course of years. Now we've got 12,000 businesses that have gone through the program. Art, the question I'm constantly asked is, are you going to rename the program, Asahi? Because it's no longer... You've got to 10,000, you know, you're at 12,000. So we're not going to rename it, but we're getting the message out there that we're at 12,000. And we've just committed, our CEO, David Solomon's phenomenal. And just we committed with him to reach another 10,000 businesses across all 50 states.
Now, it's a wonderful program. I've had a chance to go to a couple of the graduations. I was at one in Maryland recently, right outside of Baltimore. And it was quite an affair, you know, to have your CEO present at, you know, an event like this. It was at a drive-in movie theater. And he got up there and spoke about the program. They had the mayor of the city there, of course, other dignitaries. And more importantly, you had businesses there who were getting a chance to talk about how the program has affected what they're able to do. So congratulations to you all on that. And I would also say, it seems to me that businesses, corporations in particular, can take a chapter out of what you're doing, because what firm better to help businesses than Goldman Sachs? You know, you are all about helping businesses to make money. You know, that's what you do. You know, you drive the success of corporations. And it just seems to me that this should be, and probably is, a strategy that many companies employ to try to take the best of what they do and also make that also part of their philanthropy. And in this case, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm so glad you were able to join that graduation, because very often where business owners are saying, I started this business right out of high school. Many of them didn't go to college. This is the first graduation I've had in years. Some of our business owners didn't finish high school and have poured their lives into their business. Others have, you know, tapped into their 401k, borrowed money from friends to put it into this venture that they hope would succeed. And now they're getting this robust education to get their business to the next level. So I get emotional, I have to say, every time I go to these graduations, because it's real, right? You know, there's, you know, the whole family that's involved in these businesses and the employees as well. So it's a wonderful, wonderful, you know, way to be part of their growth and to watch their journey.
Well, there are other ways too that companies can play a role in shaping society. And I also came across a policy that you all have announced. I don't know how recently you announced it, but it was focused on making sure there was diversity in boardrooms. I was very impressed that you have a proxy policy, I think I understand it to be, that requires any company that you will be investing in to have a certain number of board members of diverse backgrounds. Would you talk about that a little bit? And how did you all come across that proxy concept?
Yeah, so this was, I'll take you back to Davos, January 2020. And our CEO, David Solomon, announced that day that we wouldn't IPO any company that didn't have at least one diverse board member. And that moved to two diverse board members in July, of which one must be a woman. And I have to tell you, Art, it was sort of the announcement heard around the world. I was here in New York. I have a TV in my office because I always want to know what's happening in the markets. And David, I flipped from channel to channel and he was on every channel saying Goldman Sachs is not going to buy, you know, IPO a company that doesn't have, you know, diversity on its board. And people are saying like, what's the client reaction going to be? You know, should a corporation be doing this? And it's been amazing to watch, you know, almost 2 years now later in January of next year, what's really happened. Couple of things. One is the client reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. In fact, they've actually come to us and said, we want diversity on our board. Can you help us get there? Do you know phenomenal women? Do you know phenomenal Latina man who can help us on our board? And so we've actually started a group internally that's specifically focused on helping our clients achieve these goals that they would like to achieve in terms of greater diversity on their board. I was just at a big event on Friday. We had about 200 executives, and all we were talking about was board diversity. And this is not just public company boards. It could be a private company board. Also, the nonprofit boards also need a lot of help from a diversity perspective. And so it's been incredible to sort of watch the reaction to it and watch the client feedback on it in particular, because that was the one that I would have to say there was particular sensitivity about, and to watch this outpouring from our clients to say, great, help us get there. And Goldman to say, okay, we're going to build up infrastructure to help you get there.
Wow. I mean, that's really impressive. I mean, it's something that is sorely needed in corporate America, I think, because our society is growing continually, continuing to grow diverse. And the places where you're going to be doing your business are going to be with people of color. And shouldn't they have some say in how the corporations and their policies are shaped at the top? It just makes all the sense in the world to me. And so when I saw it, you know, I was really impressed, but also I felt this is kind of bold. You know, no one else is really out there, you know, making this kind of stake in the ground. And it's also the kind of thing where a corporation could take a lot of criticism potentially from some stakeholders.
You're right. It's audacious. And what was interesting is that we looked at sort of how companies with diverse boards perform versus companies that didn't have diverse boards. And the data really supported the fact that companies with diverse boards perform better, right? And so you can go to a CEO and says, look, do you want to leave money on the table or do you not? Because you're leaving money on the table, the data shows, by not having a diverse board. And so it's been interesting to sort of watch the arc of companies with diverse boards and non-diverse boards in terms of their actual business returns, revenue, and performance, and know that the decision to do that is actually supported by the sort of revenue fact.
Yeah, it's always great when you can not only do the right thing, but make money doing it.
There you go.
You know, and that's great that you've taken that approach, because, you know, when people ask me about diversity initiatives, I say they're not going to succeed unless you can make a business case for them, whether that be a philanthropic business case that you're going to achieve greater impact through your philanthropic work, or in this case, business. You have to demonstrate that there's going to be a financial or programmatic value coming from it. And it's good that you took that approach. It's great to do right, but it's also great to do right and make money. So congratulations. So I want to talk a little bit more about you.
Oh,
you started this interview off by saying, Art, if you would have told me that I would have ended up in this role when I started at Goldman Sachs, I wouldn't have believed it. Well, I want to go beyond that. I want to go past that. Let's get back before that. Asahi was a young girl at some point trying to decide what she wanted to do in her life. And what was it about your upbringing and your rearing, that the relationships that you were able to establish early in your life that sort of set you on this path? What were some of those unique moments? And I ask this question because, you know, people are going to look at you and say, oh, of course, she was always, you know, Asahi Pompei, the partner at Goldman Sachs, right? She just kind of dropped in out of the sky into this role. But we know that's not the case. We know that you had struggle. We know that there were moments when you probably doubted yourself, but here you are. What went on in your early life that got you here? What hurdles did you see yourself overcoming that sort of led you to this great position that you now hold, where you're not only able to help your firm, but you're able to help people around the globe?
I think I'm probably the most unlikely Goldman Sachs partner. My family of seven, and I have four siblings, and my parents immigrated from Guyana to Brooklyn. We went to the Vanderveer Housing Projects on the corner of, for those New Yorkers, Foster and Nostrand Avenue, where my aunt lived. And we moved in with my aunt, who had a son, she and her husband. There were three of them, and the seven of us moved in. So there were 10 of us in this one-bedroom, one-bath apartment in the housing projects, and we lived right next to the incinerator, because that was that apartment cost less because it was right next to the incinerator, apartment 4F. And we came in October. By November, my parents had found jobs. My mom was helping my aunt, who was working as a home aide. And my mom did the weekends, and my aunt was taking care of an elderly woman during the week. And so she did that on the weekends. And my dad started working at Chuck Full O' Nuts. And this was a man who was a teacher in Guyana. And he was in the vats of coffee at Chuck Full O' Nuts, packing bags and shoveling coffee into bags. I remember he would come home smelling of coffee. And he had his back brace after a while, that he had this big leather belt that daddy always had around his waist in the years, early years that he worked at Chuck Full O' Nuts. And we were always, I grew up in a family of educators. So lots of my aunts are school principals or teachers. My dad, as I mentioned, was a teacher. And so education was always the importance of it and was always something that was stressed. And also the fact that my parents had dreams for me that were far bigger than I had dreams for myself. And they were preparing their kids to go to rooms they likely thought they would never get to, but you, my child, will get to those rooms. To go to places they thought, I'm probably not going to get to go there, but I'm going to try to build you that you will get to go to those places. And they didn't shield us from the struggle, right? Remember, I'd go to Pathmark and, you know, there was that little metal thing that you would put when you were to separate your things from another person's things at the grocery store. And my mother would put it between the essentials and the nice to have. And you'd put your Bubblicious and hope your Bubblicious gum would be on the side. But when that line was crossed, we didn't have any more money to pay for it. And you knew that, you know, not occasionally, more times than not, she'd put your Mars bar, your Snickers bar over the line. But you knew, and she would tabulate exactly how much it was. And all of those items you'd put back, and we'd run around trying to put them back on the shelves because the money was up. And so there was a keen understanding around individual responsibility and the importance of education, and that you were going to have to find your way and you're going to have to make your way and make your path and then contribute to the family. I have two younger brothers that are a decade and 10 and 11 years younger. And so that was life. And I saw how late they would work. And my dad worked the night shift. And so he'd, you know, come home at the 7 to 11 shift. And so I think seeing their path and seeing their struggle and their joy, like it was a lot of joy in the evenings, lots of laughter and lots of other things as well. And so I think that has profoundly impacted me.
Well, you know, there are lots of people who have backgrounds like that that got nowhere close to where you are. Many of them end up in really bad situations, but somehow you rose out of it. Was there a particular thing, event, or memory that you have that really triggered you to go to another level? You said, I know that I'm going to do something really important. I think of my own self. I think of, you know, my early days. I was connected to certain organizations that really helped me get to that next place or help me see myself in a certain way that maybe I wouldn't have if I hadn't had that connection. Did you find that?
Who you are? I'm curious. I know that, but
yeah. One of the big things was my connection to the YMCA and my church. Those were two institutions that elevated me in my thinking about what I could become in life. And had good men and women who were there to work alongside of what my mother could provide to help me believe in myself and that what was around me wasn't the end. There was more that I could achieve and if I really worked at it. And so these kinds of moments, these kinds of relationships that we're able to develop early in life kind of help shape us. I always felt in my own case that there was more for me, even though I came from a pretty modest background, you know, raised by a single mom. So, you know, when I ask this question, I ask again, because people always think that it just happened for a person. It doesn't just happen. There are moments, there are things that happen in your life that help shape you, that give you a memory, that give you a lift, that will drive you to want to do more and believe in yourself, even when you might not otherwise have believed in yourself, even when others around you are falling off. So what did you see? Do you remember anything like that?
I remember in when I went to middle school, at that time, the grades were like 1 through 12, you know, 7-1, 7-2, 7-3. And I think when I started middle school, I was in 7-5, I think it was. And it was like September. By October, I had a teacher, Mr. Balsam, who had watched me, I guess, over the 6 weeks of school. And he said, in front of the entire class, I'd answered a question. And he said, "You don't belong in this class." And I thought initially I'd done something wrong. He said, "See me after class." And I came to see him after class. And he said, "On Monday, you're going to be in 7-1. And I didn't even know what 7-1 was, because I don't think I was really conscious of the fact that this was. But he literally plucked me out of 7-5 or 6, put me in 7-1. And what was a black school became a white school. Different school, different experience entirely, and changed my middle school path, which then changed my high school path. So I would have to give a big shout out to New York City school teachers. While I highlight that example, I think about all the other kids in 7, 5, 6, 7, and 8, right? Because the thing that I don't want is I don't actually like being the first, the only, an exception, because I know the richness and the talent of people from my background in this country who don't get an opportunity, who are the plant trying to grow through the cracks and who aren't plucked and whose lives are dramatically different. And so my aim is to create less exceptions and to allow more people to flourish and to grow. But if I were to go back, I would say there were really significant teachers I can point to along the way who saw something in me and didn't just let it lie languish, took the time, took the extra effort to say, "I'm going to do something. I see a spark."
Well, Sahi, we're coming to the end, but I want to ask you a couple of final questions. First of all, there's a young girl somewhere in 7-5, and her mother doesn't really know that she really belongs in 7-1. And, you know, she's in this class, probably languishing. What do you say to those girls in 7-5? And what do you say to their parents that might help them inspire their young people to not necessarily go in your path, they're going to find their own path, but to believe in themselves and that there's more for them in this life, that they can accomplish whatever they set out to do? What would you say to them? How would you inspire them?
I would say a couple of things. One is that fundamentally, that belief in yourself, you've got to keep that fire lit, because at whatever stage you are in life, there are always going to be times when they're naysayers, doubters, or you doubt yourself. And so keeping that candle burning of, "I believe in myself, I can do this, and I'm going to put the work in to keep doing this," that I firmly believe that that level of belief and perseverance really makes fundamentally a difference. So what I would say to that girl is, hold on to that belief in you and what you can do. Couple it with the hard work you've already put in and continue to put in. And it's never too early to own your own destiny. And that may mean talking to a teacher and saying, "I'd like to do X or Y or Z," or raising your hand and looking around to see, is there an after-school program? Is there an elder at church? Is there a club that I can participate in? But it starts with that belief, and then that belief coupled with action.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, you've been listening and watching Sahi Pompei, partner, member of the Goldman Sachs Management Committee, and just a wonderful person. What a great representative Goldman has in you as their face of the company's philanthropy and its philanthropic and public affairs. I am just so grateful to have you have spent this time with me on the podcast today. And I can't help but wish you, you know, tremendous success in the future as you've achieved so far in everything that you do, Asahi. And we're certainly going to be following you and supporting you in any way possible.
I thank you. I'm humbled by your well wishes, and I appreciate it. It's been terrific to have this time with you for such a thoughtful and engaging discussion. So right back at you, to you and your family and everyone. Thank you so much.
Well, Asahi, again, thank you for a great interview, great session. And to all of our viewers, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, the BBB Wise Giving Alliance's YouTube channel, where you can continue to get all of our videos from the podcast. If you're a podcast listener, please sign in to us on any major podcast platform. And you can also, as a subscriber, get the regular episodes as they come out each week. We want you to do that so you can be inspired to give and to serve. And finally, if you want to support the podcast, please do so on patreon.com or by making a donation to the BBB Wise Giving Alliance by going to our website, give.org. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay tuned for our next episode that'll come out in just a week.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's terms of service.